For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're entering into another important section that makes up the narrative of the book of Genesis. And we're going to focus in here tonight on what sometimes is called the Isaac cycle. It's about his family. Isaac is the son of Abraham, and we talked about them last time. So we pick up the narrative in chapter 25, verse 19, where it says, "These are the records of the generation of Isaac," just like I said. Isaac's son Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, as his wife. And Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was unable to have children. The Lord answered Isaac's prayer, and Rebekah became pregnant with twins. But the twins struggled within her womb, and she asked, "Why is this happening to me?" Well, the Lord said, here's your answer. "The sons in your womb will become two nations. From the very beginning, the two nations will be rivals. One nation will be stronger than the other, and your older will serve the younger." When the time came to give birth, Rebekah realized that she did indeed have twins, and the first was very red at birth and covered with thick hair like a fur coat. And so they named him Esau, which I've translated for you. It means hairy. We should just call him Harry. The other twin was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob, which, among other things, some more endearing, "My name is Jacob, deceiver." I don't know if it's fair to call him that or not. I guess we'll find out. But that's the scene as we open up the story. And like I said, this is the beginning of the Isaac section from chapter 25, really on through the end of chapter 27 and into chapter 28. It's about Isaac and his family. Toledoth is just a word that is translated the records of. There are six of them in the book of Genesis, each introducing a different section of the book of Genesis. So there's the Toledoth, or the records of creation in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. Then there's the generations of Adam, then of Noah, and of the sons of Noah and Seth, and of Abraham, and now Isaac. That's how the work is just kind of laid out in a very succinct, kind of structured way. Now we're talking about this family. And his wife Rebekah has a problem, which you as readers now are well aware of. The idea, the problem of the barren woman, which began with Sarah, the wife of Abraham, now is the problem of Isaac, the daughter of son and the daughter of Sarah, and his wife. And so pretty much right away, you as the well-schooled reader in Hebrew narrative know that this repetition of this thing is going to signal something important. Namely, that this child who is going to come is going to come because of the mercy of God. That God is going to do what human beings cannot do, and that is because God is the God of promise, and God is in a promise relationship with Abraham and his family through the line of Isaac. And so everything that we're reading then about the story of Isaac is just a reflection of the mercy and the goodness of God. Then, thirdly, is just this whole issue of names. Names to us don't really mean much. In our society, you name somebody because it sounds good or something like that. Kind of has that flow or whatever. In the ancient world, not so much. For them, they would choose names that captured sort of like the essence of the individual. And so, in this case, Esau's personality is kind of characterized by the fact that he's hairy. And later it will unfold that he's, you know, a hunter and he's kind of that kind of guy. Kind of a Daniel Boone sort. Jacob, on the other hand, is called deceiver because as his brother's being born, he's grabbing him by the ankle on the way out. And this is seen to be a bit of, riding on his brother's heels, so to speak. And that also comes to kind of characterize the personality of Jacob, namely that he's a shifty guy and that he is prone to deceit to get the things that he wants. But there is more to it than just simply personality. There is also prophecy. And so this is, of course, the important part, which is that God tells Rebekah, there are two nations represented by each of your two sons in your womb, and those sons are going to birth significant nations, and the older will serve the younger. And so those two nations become Edom, the Edomites that come from Esau, and Israel that come from Jacob, whose name later is changed to Israel. And so that's kind of an amazing thing for Rebekah. And we're going to return to Rebekah a little bit later because this little word from God becomes very important, I think, in her whole calculation of her life and her role as a mom. But let's read on. It says in verse 27, the boys grew up and Esau became a skillful hunter. He was an outdoorsman. But Jacob had a quiet temperament, preferring to stay at home, a homebody. Isaac loved Esau because he enjoyed eating the wild game Esau brought home. But Rebekah loved Jacob. You sense a problem emerging. They're picking favorites. One day, Jacob was cooking stew, and Esau arrived home from the wilderness exhausted and hungry. Esau said, Jacob, I'm starved. Give me some of that red stew. Which is how Esau got his name, Edom, which means red. So, Jacob says, all right, but there's got to be something in it for me, because after all, I'm Jacob. How about we do this? I give you a bowl of soup, you give me your birthright. Wow. To which Esau amazingly says in verse 32, look, I'm dying of starvation. What good is my birthright to me now? So they both are calculating a little bit here, aren't they? Jacob said, okay, first, you got to swear to me that your birthright is mine. And so Esau swore an oath, selling all his rights as firstborn to his brother Jacob. Jacob had to be just like, what? Really? It was that easy? Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. Esau ate the meal. Then he got up and he left and showed contempt for his rights as firstborn. Hence the title of our talk this evening, Two Boys and a Bowl of Soup. All right, this is an event with extraordinary implications. Let's break it down. Birthrights for sale? Really? I thought birthrights were bestowed upon children by their fathers. Well, that is true. It is also true, however, that the rights of the firstborn in the ancient world could actually be traded. How do we know this? Because we have documents from antiquity that correspond in time and place with what's happening here in the Isaac, Jacob, and Esau story from one of the great archaeologists of the 20th century, a guy named Cyrus Gordon. He said, this is no longer an incident without parallel. He says, the Nuzi tablets, that's in southern Syria, inheritance prospects were negotiable much as bonds and stocks are today, though only from brother to brother. And indeed, one Nuzi tablet records how a man in need of food sold his inheritance to his brother in exchange for livestock. So this is not just some mythological story that was recreated, you know, centuries after to somehow legitimize Jacob's line of inheritance as the people of God. Not at all. This is something that emerges right out of their own culture. And so there it is. And it also says something very important, of course, about Esau. We need to think about this just a little bit. Here's a real window into Esau's heart. Yes, he's out and he's hunting, and I'm sure that out there, you know, camping in the wilderness and chasing after these animals and stuff like that, that'd take the wind right out of you. No doubt he's tired. But when he says, "Look, I'm dying of starvation," we have to ask, really? Is that what someone does when they are dying of starvation? Can they actually have a linear conversation, enter into a contract, make vows, all of these things? Of course not. And Esau is exaggerating in a significant way, which is really borne out by the narrative. It says that he showed contempt for his rights as firstborn. In other words, the reality of the situation is that, yes, Esau was struggling physically, no doubt about it. The sight and the smell of this soup that his brother made had to be really enticing. And it's like, man, I've been out on the road for a while, and I'm famished, and I would do anything for this bowl of soup. But contempt for your birthright? Now that is extreme. And it just has to be understood in the framework of the narration here and the commentary that comes later in Hebrews chapter 12, rather, that Esau, this decision of his, really reflects an inner heart's attitude toward the things of God and what God was to grant him as the firstborn son of Isaac. It's like whatever it is that God has to offer just doesn't really mean that much. Really, it's no more important to me than a bowl of soup when I'm hungry. Well, we'll return to this a little bit later. It becomes important. The whole event, clearly in Esau's mind, however, meant nothing. And he ate his meal, and he got up, and he left. And that's all our narrator tells us. It was just like, you know, I was hungry. Yeah, we had this deal. I swore an oath. But, you know, whatever. My fingers were crossed or whatever it was. And then I'm gone. That's Esau's perspective. It's not Jacob's perspective. It's not God's perspective either. And Esau, while representing a contempt for the things that God would give him as firstborn, is really matched by the fact that Jacob now has heard his sworn vow. No doubt, as the ancients would practice it, in the presence of others. Very likely in the presence of his mother, Rebecca. She also was hanging around in the tents, right? And other servants. So this was not just, you know, some clandestine meeting between two guys and one of them makes a disingenuous deal and the other guy's trying to hold it to him. It's in the ancient world, when you make a vow, it is binding. Your words back in that day actually meant something. Now, we're going to move the tape forward in a significant way. Moving now to the end of Isaac's life. And it says in chapter 27, verse 1, one day when Isaac was old and turning blind, he called for Esau's older son and said, "My son." "Yes, father," Esau replied. "I'm an old man," Isaac said, "and I don't know when I may die. Take your bow and quiver full of arrows. Go out into the country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare my favorite dish and bring it here for me to eat. Then I will pronounce the blessing that belongs to you, my firstborn son, before I die." But Rebekah overheard what Isaac said to Esau. And so when Esau left to hunt for the wild game, she said to her son Jacob, "Psst, listen, I overheard your father talking to Esau, saying, 'Bring me some wild game and prepare me a delicious meal. Then I will bless you in the presence of the Lord before I die.' Now, my son, listen to me. Do exactly as I tell you. Go out to the flocks, bring me two fine young goats. I'll use them to prepare your father's favorite dish Then take the food to your father so he will eat it and bless you before he dies. Well, Jacob replies, but my brother Esau is a hairy man. Remember, we've been through this before. And my skin is soft and smooth. What if my father touches me? He'll see that I'm trying to trick him, and he'll curse me instead of blessing me. But Rebekah said, well, then let the curse fall on me, my son. Just do what I tell you. Go out and get the goat for me. So Jacob went out and he got the young goats for his mother, and she took them and prepared a delicious meal just as Isaac liked it. Then she took Esau's favorite clothes and gave them to her younger son Jacob. She covered his arms and put the smooth part of his skin, his neck, with the skin of the young goats. Then she gave Jacob the delicious meal, including freshly baked bread. So Jacob took the food to his father. Father, he said. Yes, my son, Isaac said. Who are you, Jacob or Esau?
Jacob, replied.
He replied,
it's Esau, your firstborn.
Trying to make it up, you know what I'm saying?
I've done as you told me. Here's the wild game. Now sit up and eat so you can give me your blessing.
Kind of get right to the point.
Isaac said, how did you find it so quickly, my son?
Oh, well, the Lord your God put in my path, Jacob replied. Then Isaac said, okay, come closer so that I can touch you and make sure that you really are Esau. So Jacob went closer and Isaac touched him. The voice is Jacob's, but the hands are Esau, Isaac said. Poor guy's confused. But he did not recognize Jacob because Jacob's hands felt hairy, just like Esau's. So Isaac prepared to bless Jacob. But are you really my son Esau? He asked. It's the second time. He's really kind of confused at this point. But Jacob says, I am. Then Isaac said, okay, now, my son, bring me the wild game. Let me eat it. And then I will give you my blessing. So Jacob took the food to his father. Isaac ate it. He also drank the wine Jacob served him. And Isaac said to Jacob, please come closer and kiss me. So now just like, really? This is the third time we're checking in on you. So Jacob went closer and he kissed him. And when Isaac caught the smell of the clothes, he was finally convinced. And he blessed his son. He said, ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of the outdoors, which the Lord has blessed. As soon as Isaac finished blessing Jacob, and almost before Jacob had left, his father Esau returned from his hunt. Isaac prepared a delicious meal and brought it to his father. Then he said, sit up, my father, and eat my wild game so that you can give me your blessing. But Isaac asked, who are you? Esau replied, it's your son, your firstborn son, Esau. Then Isaac began to tremble. And in the original, it's like he began to violently tremble. Then, who just served me wild game? I have already eaten it, and I blessed him just before you came. And yes, that blessing must stand. It's the law. When Isaac heard his father's words, he let out a loud and bitter cry. Oh, my father, what about me? Bless me too. He begged. But Isaac said, your brother was here and he tricked me. He has taken your blessing away. And Esau explained, no wonder his name is Jacob. Remember that, deceiver. For now he has cheated me twice. First he took my birthright, and now he has stolen my blessing. Haven't you saved a blessing for me? And Isaac said, Esau, I have made Jacob your master and have declared that all his brothers will be his servants. I have guaranteed him an abundance of grain and wine What is left for me to give you, my son? Oh, wow. What a terrible parting shot for Isaac. What a terrible place his eldest son Esau has come to. The blessing has been stolen. And here there is also something very much at stake that we need to think about together as well. Namely, Rebecca. Yeah. Usually when we talk about this passage, we're talking about two boys and a bowl of soup. The reality is, however, that the emphasis given to this text really centers on Rebecca. In the lead up to the birth story, there's almost an entire chapter given to the fact that Isaac needs to go outside of Canaan and to Midian and to find a wife that is suitable. And he finds there Rebecca, or actually his servant does, and brings her back. And this whole very long, drawn-out thing, which is consistent with how Hebrew prose is written. The longer a sequence, the more important it is. The text slows down, so it gives us a sense of what's really important, what's going on. And the text really slows down in a significant way by introducing us to Rebecca. She's very important in this calculation. It's Rebecca, not Jacob, who concocts this plan to go into the tent of Isaac and to steal the blessing. She's the one who's done it. Because she knows that vows and blessings are absolutely binding. An oral contract is as good as any contract in the ancient world. It's really reflected in the law of Moses that will come generations later. In Numbers 30, verse 2, it says, when a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. You know, there was just really something in the ancient world about truth-telling. Your word meant something then. Your word was all about your respect, your dignity. If you've said it, then it is absolutely binding. And that's, of course, why Isaac was at pains to determine, is this in fact Esau who I'm talking to? Because once he puts it out there and he swears his blessing on his son, there is nothing he can do, there's nothing anyone can do to reverse that blessing. Rebecca knew that that was the case. That is the way that the law worked in the ancient Near Eastern world. So, why does she do this? Why? Is it just because she had a soft spot in her heart for Jacob, unlike Esau? Is that what it is? Just choosing favorites? We think not. And there are important clues in the text, actually, that show us the significance of what Rebecca has done here. First, she is aware of the promise that God makes to her son Jacob. Remember what the promise was? The older shall serve the younger. So she knew that no matter what shakes down with Isaac, Jacob is going to be the son of promise. And so she connives and she manipulates. That is not in her favor. It's not a good thing to have a scheme like that. But she, at the same time, has this confidence of knowing that it is Jacob who will be the one who carries on that promise that God made first to Abraham, then to Isaac, and now to Jacob. Because why? Because God said so, that's why. And that's what gave her this boldness. Second, there is a deep fear that she and Isaac share about Esau's character. There are things about him that really render him unqualified to be the kind of man to carry on this godly legacy, this promise. So, for instance, we see in chapter 26, verse 34, Esau was 40 when he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Basemat, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Well, that's important because here is Esau marrying women from the land. These are Canaanites. And there's a deep concern that Rebecca has that the coming together of these two widely divergent cultures is going to spell bad news for God's people going forward. And for this reason, really what Rebecca is doing is setting a very important example for future generations. Look what it says. This is Genesis 27:46. Towards the end of Rebecca's life, she says, if Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, from the daughters of this land, what good will be my life to me? She exclaims. It's as though everything that matters to me will be thrown on the rocks. And so it says in chapter 28, verse 1, so Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of the Canaanites. Now, this is, again, this is super important. And really what Rebecca is doing is she's setting an example, because in the generations to come, when under Joshua, the land is possessed, there will be a temptation to intermarry with the Canaanites. And yet, they do that to their own demise. And so we're told, for instance, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 43 and 44, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. That's the deep concern that Rebecca knows already is there. Here is a culture that there's no way to blend that culture in the things that God is trying to communicate to his covenant people about who he is and about what his plan for the universe is and their place in that plan. And so in this way, as the children of Israel are preparing to enter into the land those 400 years later, Moses can bring out this event and he can say to them, let's be like Rebecca and make sure that we really are caring for the integrity of our families and our faith by not intermarrying with this culture with whom there is no making peace on spiritual grounds. Well, that is absolutely worked out in the narrative of Esau later, and in other members of Jacob's family who begin to assimilate, that their hearts turn away from God. And so really what Rebecca is doing is seeking to preserve the spiritual integrity of her household. And in that way, she stands tall. She's the only one in the whole Isaac cycle who really stands out as a person of demonstrable faith, who's willing to risk for the sake of protecting the people of God. So there's something in that for us. Now, let's turn to the kind of central lesson, the contrasts that we see. What is unambiguous about this is this whole issue of Esau's choice. How could Esau's choice have ever made sense to him or to anyone else? What could possibly be going through his mind that he would trade his birthright and all of the possessions of his father's household and the opportunity to become a part of this promised legacy of God for a bowl of soup? It just sounds insane until we begin to realize maybe we're a little bit more like Esau than we realize. Let's break this down just a little bit. Like Esau, we face life-defining, heart-revealing decisions. He's not unique in this. We all face decisions of this kind. And in a broad range of ways, not just about who we're going to marry or what kind of soup we're going to eat or whatever. But our lives really are the consequence of key decisions that we are making over time that establish the trajectory for us in important ways. And so here's the question I want us to really ponder together here tonight. How do you see the world and your place in it? As you are faced with the many decisions over the course of your life, The promise of God, the bowl of soup. It's not always that clear to us, is it? But we are making these decisions. We're making all manner of decisions. How do you see the world and your place in it? That is the center of how we need to live our life, how we need to think about the important decisions that are in front of us. And so I want us to think about this from the standpoint of this narrative here together. We may see choices before us that seem maybe insignificant, like they don't really matter all that much, or perhaps that they are even virtuous, versus a decision in the other direction that seems very much to be swimming against the tide of our culture, of the things that are important to the people around us. I've chosen the expression against the tide for a reason. There was a great Christian leader in the early 20th century in China named Watchman Nee. Some of us know that there are more Christians today in China than there are in America. That's a fact. That's a reality. More people gather together in homes, largely in underground, anonymous places in communist China today than assemble together in churches on Sunday morning all over the United States. A very significant percentage of those people are doing that because of the life and the legacy of Watchman Nee. It was he who started a house church movement, really the legacy of Hudson Taylor, the great missionary to China. And Nee made some very important decisions. He was an educated man. He was an intelligent man. He qualified to go to law school, and many of his friends did. He chose a different path. He chose the path of Bible teaching, of writing, and trying to encourage the propagation of these house churches throughout China. Later in his life, right before World War II, he says in his biography called Against the Tide, he was on a train, and he sat down by a man, a well-dressed man, a dignified man, obviously a successful man. And they looked at each other and realized, I know you. We went to school together. And they began to engage in a conversation. And here is Watchman Nee, not a well-dressed man, a man dressed in the clothing of a pauper, the kind of clothes that somebody who has really left their stake in this world would wear, someone without real means, someone who's not inching up into the wealthy class. And they just looked at each other and they realized we are two profoundly different men. Both men of Christian faith. Yes. Both men of Christian faith. One making decision after decision to do what? To do what made sense that the world put in front of them. Succeed, of course. Get ahead. Make something of yourself. Be somebody. The other, a bit of a different vision. A vision that says, how can I find myself in a place to be increasingly available to be a servant of the living God? What's the difference between these two men's trajectories? It is how they answered this profound and fundamental question that I put forth before you just a second ago. What do the key decisions in your life tell you about your place in the world and what's true about it? It's here in these life-defining decisions. Who will I marry? Where will we live? What kind of pursuits will I have? What's really important to me in the long run? And am I willing to orient my life around the key commitment of my life? Or will I let the world around me define what is success and just simply and mindlessly pursue these things and fit the things of God in as I'm able? And those are two fundamental different trajectories rooted in a fundamentally different answer to this all-important question. What is the nature of reality and of your place in it? And that will always be, whether subtly or obviously, the critical issue that will define the legacy of your life. Do you hear me? Because this is like super important. And a lot of us here tonight have many, many years ahead. And so the decisions that we're making now, even the ones that may seem trivial, simple, easy decisions to make, will have long-term influence in terms of the trajectory of our lives. Are we ones who are making those decisions in light of a conscious interaction with this question? What is it really all about, and what's my place in the grand scheme of things? Now let's just unfold it a little bit more. There is obviously a contrast in this narrative between the temporal and the eternal. And here, God has made a promise, a huge promise, to this family. And Esau grew up in the knowledge of this promise. It's a promise that God made to his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham before him. He knew as the firstborn that this is a promise that would come to him, or so he thought. God says, I will establish the oath I swore to your father Abraham, and I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's God's promise to this household. So Isaac is making a calculation based on his understanding of the nature of things and how he fits in. And his assessment was, what really matters is the hunt. What really matters is my game plan, the things that I'm about, the things that are gratifying and satisfying to me. These things I will pursue, even if it means that I am opting out of the opportunity that through me, God's plan, the cosmic plan of God, the plan of God to reach every people group in the world through me, not that interested. How about you? What keeps you up at night? I've been thinking about this quite a bit, because I end up staying up too much at night. And it seems to me that we really also are at this place when we're what has our affections, what really competes for our attention. It's the same sort of temporal versus eternal thing that Esau also was engaging. And, you know, we do have an opportunity, according to the scriptures, to make an eternal impact with our life. That's right. We're given talents by God to invest in the things of God that translate into a different picture of how eternity looks based upon the role that we voluntarily enter into and play. That's what the Bible teaches. He created you for eternity to make an eternal impact. And yet we have all these things that give us a very different message, and we have got to answer this question: what is real and what is my place in it? And I'm one who believes deeply that God has raised us up. He's raised me up. He's raised all of you up. He's raised this church up distinctly to be a voice in this city, in this culture, in this day, and beyond to the world. Do you believe that? How deeply do you believe that? Deeply enough that it affects your decision making, deeply enough that it affects your sleeping habits, This is really the question. You know, it was just Esau's reflexive response. The soup is more important than the promise. He clearly had not been thinking about that. He just impulsively acted. And we impulsively act as well, unless we're prepared to ask these difficult questions. What is the nature of things and what is my place in it? And the nature of things is that God is using his church to create a spiritual revolution to rescue lost people who are walking into an eternity of separation from God, and he's calling them back through us. That's what he is doing. And that's the kind of thing that needs to shape our passions and our heart. Or our reflexive response to the choices that come before us are going to be as misguided, short-sighted, and compromised as Esau's. That's just because that's just the way things work in this world. And To be a person of God for our day is to make those decisions so consciously, to go and seek and save what is lost, to be that ambassador for Christ, and to call upon the Lord. Paul uses the language in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. I beg you on behalf of God, Christ, be reconciled to God. See the intensity in his voice. You see what I'm saying? Because a tepid, casual, inconsistent testimony to a lost world is never going to be enough. They cannot and they will not hear it through the static, the noise, the distraction of this culture. Why will they hear? When will they hear? When God's people have the heart of God for the things that really matter and are prepared to allow their hearts to be agitated on behalf of lost people and plea and beg with God to God for the privilege of being used to turn and reshape eternity through the people around them, the people that were willing or able to touch with the good news of Jesus Christ. And that, my friends, will keep you up. What keeps you up at night? Well, I'm really kind of worried about my stock portfolio. Did I leave the coffee maker on? You know, all of these things. I think that the spiritual dynamics of this world, the spiritual forces raised up against the knowledge of God in our day, are so vastly more powerful than the lameness of the church. That's why we realize that the influence of the church in America is on the steep decline. The problem is not out there. It's not because of secular humanism or politics or the economy stupid or anything. It's because of the hearts of God's people. That's the real issue here. What keeps you up at night? And when's the last time you spent a sleepless night because somebody in your life who is far from God is so deeply on your heart that you can't rest in the knowledge of where they are? And I think that until we come to that place, our words will be, they will not penetrate. We have to have that kind of deep affection that only the Spirit of God can cultivate in the hearts of his people if we are going to really win the lost of our day. Okay, there's a battle, there's a war going on, and we have to want this more than our enemy. And so I just think, yeah, in a simple and reflexive way, we see the foolishness of Esau. We see him just surrendering the rights that are his for the sake of something immediate, something temporary, something physical, and something now. But frankly, my friends, I'm wondering, to what extent could this also be said of us? And not to be edgy or pushy or whatever about it. This is something that we need to engage before God and have his heart and have his thinking on this. And why? Because this text does speak to us after all these years. Then, of course, there's just this place that Esau ends up. Let's make it clear that God does not abandon Esau. This has nothing to do with Esau's standing with God. He still is totally acceptable to God, because our acceptance with God has nothing to do with the extent of our obedience. It has to do with our willingness to receive from God a gift that we don't deserve. Our standing with God is rooted entirely on what God does for us, not what we do for him. So that's not the issue. There is total acceptance, and at the same time, we also realize, too, that God redeems the blunders that we make in life. There's a reconciliation, we'll talk about this next week, between Jacob and Esau later in life. You sitting here tonight, some of you, and you're not as young as you once were. And you realize that you've made a lot of decisions in your life that have gone far afield, but you can now see in retrospect from what God would have called you to do those many decades ago. And so now you're kind of broken in various ways. And what we need to realize is that God does indeed redeem even our blunders. That's right. That's right. We'll be used in a different kind of way than maybe we would have, but that doesn't mean that we're unuseful to God and his kingdom. I've thought a lot about that in my own life. I made some decisions as a teenager, as a young adult, that were catastrophic to my development, intellectually, socially, emotionally, in every way. And so today I can't be the person that I could have been had I not made those crazy decisions that I made. And I still labor today with the fallout of some of those decisions that I made. It has damaged my soul. But God, because he's merciful, still has a plan for me, and I'm able to do a little bit, I guess, for the kingdom in the light of those terrible blunders that I made. But at the same time, I think that there's an attitude that Christians can have. It's just like, well, it doesn't matter what you've done. What just matters is today. And God's got a plan for you. And in a certain sense, that is true. God will always use you where you are. But there are consequences to the decisions that we make that limit the ability of God to use us in the future. And so these decisions matter. They're very, very important. And so I just want to plead with you. If you are one of these who, like me, at a certain point in my life, I remember this, laying in my bed in a rooming house full of guys, seeing them so much better put together than I was, so much more capable than me. I started college more or less as an attempt at recovery. I was functionally illiterate, and it was humiliating and embarrassing to be around people who had chosen a different way and who were just way more available to be molded and shaped by God for work. And like I said, so God's merciful, and he has taken what little I've got. But there are consequences. And please, I'm just appealing to you, especially you who are young, to really get it straightened out. What is the world really all about, and what is my place in it? And it is as we begin to view the framework of our life, the decisions that we make around these fundamental questions that we are able to then put together a life that really is that course that God has called us to. We can opt out of that, and there's real loss, but we can also make decisions to stand in there and to do what God has called us to do. And I think there's something very sobering about this Isaac narrative. Then, of course, there's Jacob. We haven't talked yet about Jacob. The story for Jacob is just beginning. What about this guy? What a dick. I mean, this guy was a cheater, a manipulator. He's no better than Isaac, it's clear. But what's also clear is he wanted the better thing. And his life took on a very different trajectory. Next week, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about Jacob, the guy who is not better, but who desired better things, and what God did to prepare him to be the baton carrier for the great promise of God to revolutionize the nations. So that's what we got to say about this passage.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.